Trees are such a stunning part of the landscape, especially when the leaves change and everything is transformed. And because they seem so stable and reliable, I think it can be easy to overlook them when we think about caring for our plants. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Bruce Allison is a certified arborist. He's also an adjunct professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and has been a guest on this show many, many times. And Bruce, great to have you back.
Larry, it's great to be with you and your listeners.
Really appreciate it. You know, the drought certainly took its toll on all kinds of plants. Certainly trees were no exception to that.
They certainly weren't. I've seen just a tremendous amount of damage to a variety of trees, and the story's not over yet. I mean, already with the initial stage of the drought, you will see the symptoms that appear on certain species particularly. I noticed the maple is looking very stressed. A lot of lower branches were lost. The leaves certainly turned brown, shriveled up very prematurely. I see arborvitae, a conifer that is one of my very favorites, the tree of life. There's a lot of dead arborvitae out there. And you can imagine why. I mean, in order for a tree to successfully grow, it needs water. The water is critical for the distribution within the tree through the vascular system. Trees don't have hearts. Yes, they've got heartwood, but it's not a pumping heart like mammals have. They instead depend upon water evaporation at the leaves or at the end of the needles to be able to pull up additional water through the root system initially and then into the trunk and into the branches through a process called evapotranspiration. It's the movement through capillary action and cohesion through those narrow vessels of the xylem cells that pull it upwards. And as a molecule of water leaves the leaf or the needle, it goes into the air, and then it pulls up the next one from lower down. If you don't have enough water in that plant, it's simply not going to be able to distribute the nutrients that it needs to in order to keep surviving. And it will show it often differentially in certain parts of the plant earlier than others, but sometimes it's a total plant collapse. And I'm sure a lot of people out there who are listening do have arborvitae in their yard that they didn't carefully water during this drought period that are now looking totally browned. The secondary problem with drought, of course, is when a plant is stressed, it doesn't have that normal defense against the insects that it typically would. One of the techniques that trees use to fend off those always-present bark beetles are to pitch out the young larva of the beetle that's trying to get through its trunk into its nice tissue underneath. And it does that. The pitching out process is merely a flooding of the hole that the insect has dug, drowning the larva, end of story. Inadequate water means those larvae get in, they start to feed, they pupate, they come back as larger, more mature beetles, and they start the whole process again. So we'll see that, I'm sure, for the next couple of years. We did after that significant 1987-88 drought. I'll see it on oak trees with the two-line chestnut borer. We'll see it on hickory trees with the hickory borer. And I wouldn't be surprised we see it in a lot of pine trees. This Ips pinei or pine bark beetle will be a more significant problem over the next couple of years than it is typically.
And, you know, I think it's probably worth it yet if you haven't watered the tree. Do you want to water right up till the ground freezes on those trees?
Well, certainly where we have a deficit, and we in many areas still do, we had, you know, plenty of moisture in most parts of Wisconsin. The drought in that sense was broken, and of course the farmers for next year are very happy for that.
Right.
But nonetheless, there is an overall deficit remaining because of this, you know, historic drought that we had this year. So if you're able to put a sprinkler or a soaker hose underneath some critical trees to protect them, give them extra moisture, it helps tremendously. And it also will give it some protection against secondary problems of frost damage. in a year where we don't have a lot of snow and there's not much moisture in the soil, that frost will go very deep. Every year, there's some amount of attrition of those fibrous roots as a result of that frost getting in there. If you can add a lot of water, and water, of course, has a lot of heat held in it, you know, therefore the lake effect. So you put that water in the soil, it freezes, and when it freezes, it releases all of that warmth, reduces the depth of the frost, and also guarantees that into next year, early in the spring, you'll have adequate moisture just in case we have another spring drought to be able to get that tree growing properly early next year.
We have several callers online. Let's go to the phones. Jim in Flambeau Flowage area. See if we can get you on. For some reason, I'm not able to do that. Yeah, let's see. I will try once more. No, can't do it. For some reason, I'll figure that out. We'll figure that out. In the meantime, stay with us, Jim and Neil and Lee and everybody else who's there. We have an email question from Ed in Genoa City, so let's take that. He says, I have a few acres with variety of trees, oak and hickory and walnut and black cherry and maple. Sounds great. I have a large number of hackberry trees that seem to be taking over. Can you give your thoughts on the value of hackberry? They seem pretty aggressive. Should I be controlling them?
Well, it depends why you're growing your trees up there. If you're trying to produce a hardwood stand with the idea of doing sustainable forestry or logging later on, the hackberry will be less valuable to you than would the oak, the walnut, the hickory, the black cherry. If you go to the listings of tree values at the sawmills, you'll discover that it used to be walnut was the prized plant, more dollars per board foot than anything else. It's been replaced by the cherry. People love to have their cherry cabinetry. So cherry is the most valuable. Red oak, which is always somewhat valuable, but still holds a high value, followed by walnut. So hackberry would be much further down and really would have a very low sawmill value if you're, again, thinking, 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the road doing a sustainable forestry operation. Now, having said that, if your goal is just general wildlife habitat, having forest cover for all the multiple benefits that a forest provides, such as excellent water management, such as a cooling effect in your neighborhood, the aesthetic benefits that accrue to you, hackberry is contributing very nicely to that. The hackberry is related to the elm. It's a very strong, sinewy wood. It does produce, as the name would suggest, little berries that are available to wildlife also. And it doesn't have a lot of disease and insect problems. Mm. So it's certainly one that should be part of a general mix of a good native forest. So I would not perceive the need to be cutting those down. I would not call it invasive. It certainly is a successful surviving tree, but the other ones should be able to compete quite appropriately, the species that you named.
Kim has on our Facebook has a question about her Japanese white tigress maple. It was burned back on some branches after its first winter. It's 15 feet from the east side of the front of our home in moist soil. Did I put this tree too close to my home?
Well, I presume by burning you mean sort of a frost damage that occurred that became obvious in the spring. And it could very well be because there are these things called microclimates. If you have a south-facing masonry house, tremendous amount of heat load building up in that stone, and that will indeed affect a variety of plants nearby. The reason it affects it is that when a tree goes into dormancy, it's dependent upon some regularity that nature has normally provided. That is, when it gets cold, it stays cold, doesn't get up to 80 degrees during the winter months. The tree is able to survive the winter by taking that moisture, which is inside the cell walls, and putting that outside of the cell walls so that when that water freezes, crystallizes, and of course when water freezes, it expands, it doesn't rupture the cell wall. However, if you warm things up during the midwinter, the tree is stimulated to let that water go back into the cell wall, and then of course that night it freezes and it ruptures that cell wall. You'll have the same effect if you were to put your carrot, which would do fine in the refrigerator, put it in the freezer and see what happens afterwards. It becomes quite limp because all that cell wall structure has been ruptured as it froze up in the freezer. So that's what you're seeing. That's that so-called frost damage. Often is not symptomatic until the spring, but it's caused by that type of extra heat load. So not knowing the full details, but that's probably what is occurring if it's near the house and building up some heat.
Well, let's turn to Jim in Flambeau Flowage now. Jim, hi, are you there?
Hi, I hope so. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Say, first of all, I have to tell you, we're big, big fans of your program. It's just terrific.
Thank you.
Yeah, we had significant tornado damage in our cabin on the Flowage, and it exposed us to some neighbors, that, which is fine, but we had been reading about a hybrid willow that grows 2 to 3 feet a year, and it appears like it's something that's appropriate for our temperature up there. Any suggestions, or is this something you've heard of, or is this just too good to be true?
Probably too good to be true. there's a lot of advertisements about, you know, Asian trees that'll grow, you know, several feet a year, and the problem is that most of these are non-natives, and therefore they're introduced into an environment where there's little defense against the fungal and the insect problem. So they might indeed grow, but they might then have all kinds of problems that would make them less desirable. I would, as much as possible, stick with native trees. And certainly there's, you know, there's native willows, the white willow, even the Salix babylonica, the weeping willow. Knowing that willow have their, you know, shortcomings in terms of being very vulnerable to wind damage. And there might very well be some, you know, hybrids that some nurseries are now selling that have a characteristic growing a little bit faster than the others. But I would, as much as possible, stick with natives. And if you're really looking for screening, perhaps being a little bit patient to, you know, another couple years, having a plant that is going to be much more tolerant of, you know, future tornadoes or windstorms, so that you don't have 10 or 11 years invested in a plant and just have it knocked down and have to start all over again.
Sure. Our intention was, and one of the things that they said about this, that you can actually keep it pruned back so it's more hedge-like.
Yes.
Keep it at 8 or 9 feet or something.
Keep it at that height. Well, except for the deer issue, up in your area, I would say the arborvitae, the Thuja occidentalis, would be an excellent choice because it provides year-round screening, assuming it's a year-round home for you up there, as opposed to the willow. And because of its shape, it's much more tolerant. It's much more tolerant of wind and snow. It's aerodynamic. It's probably going to last a lot longer than the others would also.
I remember a muskie fishing trip on the Flambeau Flowage when a tornado came through, and we were in our cabin and watched a boat go by about 30 feet in the air. So I know about what's that?
That might have been my boat.
I tell you what, it was quite a trip. Jim, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bruce Allison, certified arborist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller, Judith Sears-Poisson on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Our guest is certified arborist Bruce Allison. Happy to have him along. Thank you so much for listening in. Lots of callers online, and try Lee in Wisconsin Rapids. Lee, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Good morning. My question is there a good way to determine if a large tree is hollow and therefore dangerous as it's next to a house or something of this sort?
And the answer is yes, and particularly after Sandy blasting through and everybody watching that and realizing how many trees came down on houses, on roadways, on electric transmission lines. Everybody is much more focused on this, and I actually teach a class at the university on tree stability analysis because there are many new tools out there that allow us to see inside of trees in a way that we couldn't even imagine doing before. So let's start. Imagine you have a large oak tree, maybe it's 100, 150 years old. Saprophytic fungus, that is, you know, deadwood fungus, is almost inevitable to be there somewhere from an old wound introduced, and the interior part of the tree is not living. It is just dead tissue that new live growth is growing on top of. So once the wound is made, it's subject to decay, and of course the decay will move up and down in a column because there are certain walls of that remaining part of the tree that are stronger than others, and the weakest would be on the top and the bottom. So that's why you expect to see things move up and down. So if you have a tree with hollow on the inside, it's not necessarily an increased probability of failure. If there is sufficient shell wall, that is good enough. Trees have evolved over a long period of time and survived even though they have decay on the inside. If you take a can of, soda, a can of, Coke or Pepsi or whatever, and you step on it, it's not going to collapse. But if you step on it really hard, it will collapse. It has a very thin shell wall. It's hollow on the inside and yet is fairly strong. Usually we say that if that shell wall is at least one-third the radius of that plant, of that tree, that is going to be sufficient to hold it up just fine. There is that kind of built-in additional strength that the wood has. If you visually look at that tree and you see some bulges on the main trunk, it doesn't have a normal taper, that's called the body language of a tree. That might be a clue that something is going on the inside. The tree has a characteristic called thigmomorphogenesis. Thigmo is to touch or to perturb. Morphogenesis, as you would imagine, is change its shape, grow a new shape. When there is any kind of wind pressure on the top part of that tree, in order to have stability, you have to have that pressure go down to the root system where it is the reciprocal force that's holding it there. Otherwise, that trunk would be like the mast of a sailing ship, just pushed right along. In order to get down there, you have these mechanical stresses that are moving down. If you've got a solid trunk, the tree has plenty of area for those mechanical stresses to move down. If you have just a shell wall on the outside, you have additional stresses building up in that shell wall, and the tree responds by growing additional wood in that area, and that creates a bulge. So look for those bulges that I'm referring to that don't look typical. If you see those bulges and you're suspicious you might have a problem, there are now tools that you can do to drill into the tree, and you don't want to do it unless you've got good reason to, because it does create a wound. And you can either just with a hand drill in, and if it pulls out all of the sawdust that's looking blackened or you don't feel any resistance, then you know you might have decay on the inside. If you have an arborist nearby who has one of the tools called resistographs, which are micro drill resistance tools, they can actually send a very small, like a 1.5 millimeter shaft into the tree and then create a graph showing the change in torque resistance as you move along. And that also would create a map of where you have a hollow or decay on the inside. And then if you're really lucky, you have an arborist nearby who has one of these acoustic tools where you use sound waves to be able to measure how quickly a sound wave is able to move from one side of the trunk to the other not exactly ultrasound because it's impact-induced sound waves, but we know that in solid wood, that sound wave will move more quickly. If you have a big area of decay on the inside, the sound wave has to move around. So those are some of the tools that are now available for us to be able to see on the inside of the tree. For you to do it individually, use that body language of trees. Take a look at it carefully and see if you see those bulges. Also look for fungal conchs. Sometimes when that fungus is just about out of wood, it sends out that shelf fungus, which is a sporangia, to be able to produce more spores and grow on. Certainly look for that also.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. And Joya in Fitchburg, we are turning to you next. Hi, Joya. Thanks for calling. Joya, are you there? We may have lost her. Let's try Chris in Watertown then. Chris, are you there?
I am here.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
Great show as usual. I have a cabin up in Spooner, Wisconsin, and there's a considerable drop-off from the cabin level to the lake level. And I find that we get lots of saplings making it up maybe about waist chest high, and then they peter out. But we've got an erosion problem. So what tree, very sandy soil. Well, I can't really ever keep ground cover going, but I would, so maybe a shrub or a tree to help stabilize that slope soil and prevent further erosion.
And Chris, I presume that you also want a nice view to the lake, so you don't want to have anything too tall that's obstructing your view from the cabin down to that lake. One that would work, I think, quite well in those sandy soils in your area would be a juniper. A juniper is very drought tolerant. It depends upon which one you choose, but you might be able to get those that are lower, almost rug-like in growing, and they will do a beautiful job of creating a very fibrous root system to hold that sandy soil in place. And they'll also create a wall when you have that high-velocity rain. They will absorb, hold moisture like a sponge on the top before it goes into the soil. They will absorb the velocity of those raindrops so that it doesn't hit the soil and cause it to erode with all that real erosion that you often see on bare soil. So that's certainly one you might want to consider.
Is that for deer attractants? Because arborvitae won't last unless they screed them in.
Exactly. Arborvitae are just going to be a problem wherever you have deer. They just love the ascorbic acid or vitamin C that the arborvitae offers. Mm-hmm. The junipers are going to be very protected against the deer because if you put your hand on that juniper, it's quite... not thorny, but it doesn't feel good on your hand, and it certainly doesn't feel good on the palate of those deer also. So the deer are not going to be a problem. Occasionally, I will see meadow vole being a problem. Meadow vole, of course, during the winter will get onto the bark and feed and girdle over there. But I doubt in that particular conditions that you're describing there that meadow vole are going to be a big problem.
There you go. Good luck. Thanks.
Yeah,
thanks a lot for calling. And let's turn to Bob, who is in the Crivets area. Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have I live up here. I have my cabin as well as my home is just to the east or just to the west of Terry Andre Park. Last year, I dropped a maple in my yard that was well over 100 years old. The whole center was hollow, and once I cut it up in pieces and started splitting it, it was full of pigeon tree mex horntails. Are you familiar with that?
Say that again. What?
Okay, it's called the pigeon tree mex, M-E-X, horntail, and the giant Ishlan wasp.
Oh, the wasp. Okay. Actually, I'm not familiar with those, but those would be supposed to be secondaries.
Okay, I had worked for the Power and Light, and then I retired when I was young, and I worked for the DNR for a while, so I had some contacts up here, and they got me in contact. Dan Mertz, a forestry manager up here, got me in contact with a lady in Madison. Okay, and I do have the printout here. It's from the insect series Home and Garden. I don't know if you're familiar. It's number 5, 604. Okay. And you can get it through the Colorado State University Extension. And I have their, I think you'd really want to check this out if you're not familiar with these. The thing will kill the tree completely, and it moves from silver maple to ash.
Huh.
And it burrows right in. It's so I would say the wasp that the horntail that's in there will live inside that tree for about a year. Once the egg is laid, it takes them a year to get out of there. If you process this wood and use it for something, okay, they've been known to come right through the drywall. The ones that would be left in there, the drywall or hardwood floors or anything like that.
Hmm.
Okay, so I didn't know anything about this, and I got up here where I used to work for Governor Thompson State Park part-time, and talking with them people, and he came up with the answer for this. It's WW.
Bob, it's WW what?
Ah!
Oh, we just lost him.
We do.
But it sounds like it's the University of Colorado has some details on that. Well, I'm not familiar with that at all, but obviously if it's introduced, problem or invasive, the DNR should be on top of that one for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. We have, you mentioned, talking about insects, Judy emailed and wondered if you could talk about the weevils that go into the top of pines. I've had this problem. I've had to cut out off the affected areas of some of my pines from these weevils.
Yes, exactly. Well, the pine tip weevil has always been a classic problem for the pine plantations we have here. And it indeed, as she's well aware, in its larval stage, will feed on that apical leader, that very tip. And once it's dead, because those pines have a symmetry, which is a function of the fact that on the very top bud, it produces an auxin that reduces the competition from those lower lateral branches. If it goes and you don't have this growth regulator controlling the other smaller branches below, those smaller branches then start growing much more quickly, and therefore you will get these three or four branches competing for the new apical leader. It is controlled by the height of the tree that will stimulate it to produce that particular growth regulator. So once that top is gone, you'll often get sort of this horned look. You'll get two or three coming up. You see that in the woods. And it's a big problem. It's not so easily controlled. Once you see it, you indeed do have to, cut out those infected branches. There are certainly some insecticides that can be used, but it's very difficult to do something like that on a broad basis with a large group of trees.
Bruce Allison, our guest certified arborist, great to have him along. Thank you so much for listening in. We really appreciate it on this edition of Garden Talk. And Stein in Richland Center has a question, so let's go to Stein. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, Bruce, how you doing?
Hi, Stein. Good to hear from you.
Yeah. Say, I got a question about a bur oak tree. It's we've got one just up the road from our driveway. It lies in the town right-of-way, and the town road crew periodically talks about, hey, we should cut that down before it falls down. And I just wondered if you could maybe give me an age estimate on how old it is and how long it's likely to be around, because I know those guys hang around for quite a few years. I measured its circumference at about shoulder height. It's about 10 feet around the tree. Just wondered how long that bur oak would take to get that old. And it looks healthy. We haven't done those measures of trying to, see what's going on inside, but it sure looks good, and I just wonder if you give me some idea.
No, you bet, Stein. Well, there's no question that we want to, if we possibly can, preserve some of those senior citizen trees out there. I did a study in 2001 following up on a work done by Walter Scott in 1976 for the celebration of our country's birthday, 200th birthday. And what he did in the county of Dane did an 8-mile radius around our state capitol look for all those trees that could be identified as being 200 years old, that is growing at the time of the inception of our country. There were about 500 or 600 that he was able to identify. The standard we used was indeed at 4.5 feet elevation, which is where the foresters call diameter breast height. If it had a 10-foot circumference on a white bur oak, then we could comfortably say that that was a 200-year-old tree. I went back 25 years later after Walter Scott's initial study, and Walter Scott was one of my mentors. He got me started in writing the books that I did on Wisconsin's famous historic trees. He was the one who started the Wisconsin Champion Tree Program back in 1941. So I followed up, discovered that little more than half of those trees 25 years later were still there, and measuring the difference between what he had in 76 and what I had in 2001 was able to confirm that, yeah, that's about how much a tree would have to grow in order to have a 10-foot circumference, 200 years old. So you've got a bicentennial oak there.
Wow.
And if indeed you are seeing any kind of root decay problems that would become symptomatic by having the top part of the tree decline, it's not fully leafed out, especially in the upper part, that is the part farthest away from the roots, then you might indeed have a tree that, you know, could have the potential to fall over. If you don't see those bulges, if you don't see fungal conks, there's no reason that a tree that has arrived at 200 years old, if it has a normal growing site and has no indication of serious decline or decay or root damage, no reason it couldn't grow on to be, you know, 450 years old.
Wow.
The largest bur oak in the state of Wisconsin, I've identified at being about 450 years old based on its size. Magnificent tree.
Boy, that near, wonderful.
In Waukesha County. If you haven't seen the picture of that, it's listed in the DNR's Urban Forestry, the DNR's Champion Tree Program. But they can live a long time. And don't you wish that humans could figure out, you know, what that gene is that allows them to live that long?
There you go. Thank you so much, Stein, for calling. I really appreciate it. And Susan in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to take us back to the issue of the drought's effect on trees and shrubbery.
Sure.
I live in a small condominium, a group of duplexes, and all of our many, many planted trees and shrubbery are owned in common so that no individual owner is assigned for caring for the tree or bush or shrub. This last year, since last summer, we have assessed with the company that does our lawn mowing and whatnot that we have lost up to 25 trees, bushes, and shrubs. And there is currently a small group of us who are looking first at preventive things that we can do yet this fall to not lose more of our greenery. And secondly, we're looking for people who could work with us or consult with us over the next year. We've formed a task group to help prevent this in the long run. And so that's the two-parted question that I have for Bruce. If he could just review what we might do yet this fall or even in the spring to prevent further loss, and maybe point us to some places of consultation to work with us on this problem over the next year.
Well, great, Susan. These are great questions because they apply to so many people out there who have lost a significant percentage of their landscape trees to this, you know, worst drought ever in the state of Wisconsin.
Right.
And if indeed the people at, NOAA and other people that are sort of tracking these sort of things are right, we're going to continue to have this strange weather as a result of some global changes going on. And so we have to develop not just sustainability, but also some level of resilience. Resilience just means, you know, what extra things can we do to protect ourselves from that black swan event, that unexpected event that might become more frequent here.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do in terms of protecting yourself from further droughts and problems? Well, make sure that you've got the capability of bringing water in. If the rain is not doing it, nature's not doing it, you've got to be able to supplement it. Choose those plants that are perhaps less vulnerable to begin with to droughts going on.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly for the people in Tucson and in Phoenix and whatever, they get it. It's you know, they've chosen plants that can tolerate that because it becomes very expensive for them to add water just to, you know, have one thing. So it means their palette of potential choices might be reduced. But nonetheless, that is one way to develop resilience. Adding mulch is a very important thing. So after you've ascertained whether or not your soil does need more moisture this fall, then once the moisture's on, consider putting on shredded bark mulch. I don't like to have just wood scraps down there, and certainly don't put sawdust down there. I like shredded bark mulch, which is that bark which has been peeled off of logs before they go through the sawmill. It's, you know, plenty of it's available. You can either get hardwood shredded bark mulch, or you can get some of the cypress shredded bark mulch that they bring up in large truckloads from the south in the spring particularly. Lay that down. That'll keep the weeds down because it's the weeds that are also evaporating water and sucking moisture out of the soil that's not going to be available to your more desirable shrubs and trees. Plus, you will also be able to keep it a little bit cooler because it's the heat that accelerates that evaporation. As you well know, when you boil a pot of water, a lot of water goes out pretty quickly into the air. If that pot is just sitting there without the heat, it stays exactly where it is. So the mulch would be very important. Adding extra water would be particularly important. I don't think putting on these anti-desiccant sprays is a particularly good idea. Sometimes people say, well, if you spray this on, it kind of closes up the stomata or the pores that are losing the moisture. But that is, it slows down photosynthesis, is not really a good solution for you at all. So proper selection, putting them in the right spot. You might have heard my discussion earlier about somebody who had a maple that perhaps was too near the house and was picking up a heat load, and that gave it some additional problems that it wouldn't have had it been a little bit further away. And then using that mulch is a very good way to give yourself, again, some resilience against those unexpected and very problematic events that are going to be occurring in nature within our lifetime, more so than in past lives.
How do we ascertain if a particular tree or shrub needs water, or do we just assume that if it's still alive but been with us through the summer that it does need water yet this fall?
Well, part of it's science and part of it's art. So the art part is, it didn't rain very much. You know, the grass is starting to look kind of brown, and so you get a sense that perhaps it's appropriate to add some additional water. Typically, in Wisconsin, we get 40 inches of moisture per year. So that's our annual rainfall. During the growing season, it comes out to be about an inch a week. You can kind of keep track of that. If you can't personally keep track of that, then go to a website like Weather Underground that will list the historical rainfall, you know, this year and even prior years, and have the distribution over the week, because it's not just the amount of moisture, but it's also the distribution. We might have 10 inches of rain happening in, you know, late October. Well, that didn't help very much in terms of when we really needed it, when the spring and the early summer, when the majority of growth was going on and where that tree was just crying out for additional water. So another way, you can actually go to the next step, and it's not very expensive. If you go to one of the garden center retailers, you can buy a moisture meter, and you can actually put that in the soil and see how much moisture is in that soil. Gardeners are pretty good at just putting their hands in the soil and saying, oh, well, it's, you know, it's a kind of a sandy, maybe silt loam soil, and it feels like it's got adequate moisture in there. If you, you know, put your finger down and all of a sudden that hole that you've made fills up with water, then you know you've got too much water.
Too much in there.
You don't want to do that either, because too much water will actually make it impossible for those roots to pull water up. It's called, you know, being at field capacity. It will actually cause the tree to wilt. In terms of your other question about, you know, who you find for help, well, the good news is that the Wisconsin Arborist Association has done an excellent job, along with the International Society of Arboriculture, in educating arborists and having some standards that we now are able to turn to. There are certified arborists in the state of Wisconsin. There's board-certified arborists in the state of Wisconsin. So you can't depend solely upon that, but nonetheless, that is at least that first cut that you should look for. Does this person attend the conferences? Are they getting additional continuing education credits? Have they been able to pass the test to be able to call themselves a certified arborist? Did they take enough pride in their profession that they're doing that? So certainly go to that. You also have great resources in Wisconsin with our Department of Natural Resources. They have an urban forestry contingent. There are urban foresters who were focused mostly on assisting municipalities, but nonetheless, those municipalities, if you go to them, can refer then to the DNR. And our University Extension is just a remarkable resource. Go on to learningstore.wisc.edu and see all the bulletins that are available and see if that can help you better understand what's going on in your yard.
And thank you very much for calling, Susan. Appreciate your call. Bruce Allison, certified arborist, our guest on Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk. Our guest is certified arborist Bruce Allison. Great to have him along. Thank you so much for listening in. And caller Paul from Watertown has been waiting a little while, so let's go there. Hi, Paul. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I have a 6 to 8 inch diameter variegated maple that lost its leaves, all of them, in, I'm going to say, August. Now they're all coming back, and I got about 20%. They're all nice and green, and everything else is down. Looks like they want to bud out again. What's happening?
Well, and that, again, with, you know, the strange weather, with the inability to have a normal cycle, it's sometimes stimulated to think it's spring all over again. And you'll see that crab apples will often do it. You'll see, you know, a second, you know, a blossom. So nothing to be done about it other than to make sure that that tree has plenty of water. Yes, you're going to probably lose some of those buds, but the good news is that trees have the ability to recover pretty quickly. So just make sure you get plenty of water. Try to use mulch on that tree and expect that you're going to have perhaps some damage next year, but the tree should survive just fine.
Okay, there we go. Thanks, Paul. Chris in Madison. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I had a question about pruning. I have a pear tree in our backyard, and it produced really, really well this year. It was really great to get all these pears, but I'm a little worried about it because it's leaning drastically over to one side. And the more pears that came on it, the more it started to lean. I sort of erected like a little stick crutch with a fallen tree branch so that it's kind of propping up some of the branches of the pear tree, but it's still leaning over there. And I was wondering if there's something I need to do with pruning. There's a couple of branches that stick off of it that don't get any leaves anymore. And I didn't know if there was a particular time of year to do that or how to do that or where I could find that kind of information.
Well, Chris, good question. And proper pruning is really important, and especially when you have got a heavy crop. And, of course, a drought stimulates heavy crops also. Trees have the ability to sense when they need to be able to worry about the next generation. So anything that's dead, definitely prune. Now is an appropriate time to prune. You don't want to be pruning pears in the early spring because you can introduce some fire blight issues. So if you prune now, perfect. Make sure that you prune back properly to the branch bark collar. If you don't know about target pruning, then you can get a UW Extension bulletin on proper pruning of deciduous trees. If you have heavily leveraged branches, remember Archimedes who said, give me long enough lever and I'll move the earth. So it's the leverage, how long things are, that determines how much bending down and how much force is pushing down. If you can shorten that lever, you'll have less of a problem with it bending off in that particular direction. Some of those cultivated varieties of fruit trees have been produced and selected to be able to have a lot more fruit production, and they do get a little top-heavy sometimes. And so pruning to sort of shorten it, make it a little bit more compact without taking off so much that you have created a problem for not having a good crop next year, that would be a very appropriate. Try to keep it as symmetrical as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm. There we go. And thanks a lot for calling. We turn next to Rick in Madison. Rick, hello.
Hi. Hi, Larry. Hi, Bruce. I just moved to a home in downtown Madison. We've got two magnificent green ash trees.
Yeah.
And just worried about the health of them in the future with the emerald ash borer getting closer. Read a little bit about online about some possible preventative treatments. Just wondering if you know of anything that's safe, reliable, environmentally friendly to try to prevent the emerald ash borer from eventually getting to these trees.
Well, Rick, great question, and it's becoming a problem for anybody with an ash tree. In fact, all the municipalities are very concerned about this, as the number of counties that are now quarantined with emerald ash borer have increased dramatically. Here's an insect that came in 2002. It's now from Massachusetts. They've discovered out in Kansas City emerald ash borer. So, yes, the University Extension, Chris Williamson, our extension entomologist, has done an excellent job on keeping on top of this. There is a homeowner's guide to emerald ash borer insecticide treatments. I highly recommend that you get that. There's also a related one which assists the homeowner in deciding when it's time to start a preventative program. Typically, they would say if it's within 15 miles, then you should start a preventative program. Problem is, I mean, who knows where it is?
Yeah, could be in Madison right now.
Exactly. Takes 2 to 3 years, really, you know, to have enough numbers where we can successfully, you know, get those big purple traps out there. So if you have a high-value tree, it's not unreasonable to start your program now, because 2 years of preventative treatments will be helpful. If you go to Home Depot or Menards or Farm and Fleet or any number of garden centers around town, you'll see that they have a lot of these containers of Bayer's Advanced Tree and Shrub Insecticide that has a product called imidacloprid, or MERIT, M-A-R-I-T. That is an easy way for homeowners inexpensively to be able to put down a soil drench in the early spring, and do so after you've had a chance to take a look at the extension bulletins on that. And I hope that helps, Rick. It's a big problem for all of us.
That's wonderful. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Tom in Hill Point, you have a quick question.
I do. I've got a small tree plantation, and I'm thinking that my 3 to 4 year old red oaks need some pruning. And I'm wondering if it is too early in the cold season to worry about red oak, or should I? Oak wilt is what I'm trying to say.
Oak wilt, yeah. Yes. Tom, go ahead and start pruning those right now. There's no question that we're well beyond the oak wilt season. Mm. Just be particularly cautious in the spring, because that's when it's very, very vulnerable to introducing the spores into the wounds that can then create that oak wilt response in the tree. So now is a great time to be pruning your oaks.
And any other problems with other hardwoods like black cherry, black walnut, can I prune those as well now?
Yes, perfect time to be pruning those also.
Thank you.
And the weather isn't too bad for it right now either.
It's very nice out there.
It's very nice out there. Thank you. Thanks so much, Tom, for calling. Well, any last words of or words of wisdom here, Bruce, for our tree owners?
Well, I think so many people, you know, are so sensitive to the importance of trees. They know that it makes a tremendous contribution, adds value to property. And planting trees is one of the best things we can do. And I encourage people to plant not just for themselves, but for future generations. Trees are the best way that we can protect our economy, protect our environment, planting oaks particularly. I mean, plant for the future. Plant a tree that's going to be around for that 450 years. Don't be afraid of that.
That's very, very good advice. Bruce Allison, our guest today, he's a certified arborist. He's also an adjunct professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at the UW-Madison. Always great to have him along. He's been a guest for, I'm trying to think of how many years has it been? It's been a long time.
I hate to even admit it, but probably 30 years or so.
Probably right? Pretty close to 30 years. And he's done a wonderful job. Always great to have him along. And, of course, it's always great to have you listening in here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And please stay with us.